dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war we are in. The war for the free world, I call it. Our first guest calls it the long war, and he's certainly right about that. But I think the stakes, as he would agree, are exceedingly high for freedom-loving people. And I can't think of anybody really better to talk with on this 13th anniversary of 9/11 than a man who has done such a tireless job, basically from that day forward, to chronicle what is happening in this long war. He is the managing editor of the Long War Journal, a project of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, where he is a senior fellow. He is, of course, our regular featured guest here, Bill Roggio. Bill, welcome. A solemn day indeed, a day of remembrance, a day, I hope, of lessons learned. Give us your sense of where we find ourselves here 13 years on.
Good morning, Frank. And yes, it is indeed a solemn day, as you stated. 13 years after we were hit in such a horrific attack, unfortunately, I still think we do not understand the nature of the enemy that we face. We've treated this as a war against a terrorist group when we should be fighting a war against an Islamist movement, an Islamist insurgency that is hell-bent on basically world domination. So, and given that we've taken this incorrect view on the nature of the enemy, we've improperly fought it. And this is, we may have had some tactical victories, killing Osama bin Laden or killing top terrorist leaders, the initial invasion of Afghanistan or the surge in Iraq. But ultimately, it's either a stalemate or, in fact, I would actually say that the enemy is winning. Prior to 9/11, Al-Qaeda was based in Afghanistan, and you had some small basings of the group and movements that were, you know, in the Middle East and in Chechnya, but not a major, major threat. Today, the group has exploded and has affiliates worldwide in the Indian subcontinent, in the Maghreb, in East Africa, on the Arabian Peninsula, and in several of those areas, it actually holds territory.
Yeah, indeed. And that territory seems to be expanding, which brings us to the speech that the president gave last night with respect to one of the groups. He insists on calling it ISIL. And I'd like to ask you, as the chronicler-in-chief of this enterprise, Bill, to help parse for us why he does that, as opposed to calling the group what it calls itself, the Islamic State. And the character of the strategy, I guess is what we're being encouraged to call it, that he laid out last night for combating this group.
Yeah, I think he said this is not an Islamic group. So I think he just doesn't want to say Islamic State. He also is calling it ISIL, which is Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. So he wants to portray it as being a local group as well, as opposed to a group that is seeking to impose a global caliphate.
But Levant is a fairly expansive term, after all. It goes beyond just Iraq and Syria, for sure.
Absolutely. And I'm a firm believer in calling a spade, but this isn't, again, another case of refusing to define the enemy. We should call the enemy what it is. It's kind of silly to call it something that it doesn't call itself. As far as his speech, look, here you want the strategy, quote-unquote, in a nutshell. We're fighting a counterterrorism operation against an insurgent group, and we're basically going to do what we did in Yemen and Somalia, and which he ridiculously called a success. And this is my colleague Tom Jocelyn and I wrote last night, Yemen and Somalia are far from success. We've been fighting there for years, and the groups still control territory in both countries, and the governments are embattled. And these are with willing governments, so this is a strategy basically of containment. And we were told this by military officials and government officials weeks prior, and then they said, no, we're not going to contain, we're going to destroy. But if we're going with the Yemen and Somali strategy, we are going to try to contain the Islamic State.
At best. Bill Roggio is our guest of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and the managing editor of the Long War Journal. Bill, to come back to kind of the core seeming incapacity of our government to recognize the nature of the enemy we're up against, what did you make of the rather pointed statement by the president in the course of that address that this group is not Islamic? What does that tell us about the willful blindness of this government and the extent to which that disables us from being anything other than in a kind of best containing mode? You're certainly not, as you said earlier, coming to grips with the ideological character of this enterprise and presumably not able to bring to bear appropriate counter-ideological methods for dealing with it.
Ultimately, this administration and the last didn't want to define the enemy as being Islamic or part of Islam, because dealing with a religion or religious enemy is icky. They just don't want to, you know, in our world of political correctness. But the reality is there's a reason why it gains strength in some mosques. You know, this isn't an isolated group of guys with guns who just claim they're Islamic fighters. They dominate mosques. They gather their support from radical mosques. There's a significant element within the Islamic community that supports them. So yeah, they are an Islamic group, jihadist group.
Which brings me to another piece of this strategy. You have John Kerry in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia today, talking with assorted moderate Muslims, we're told, including notably the Saudis, about how we're all going to pull together and the Saudis are going to be used to train the moderate opposition that we're going to be, you know, working with in Syria to try to counteract, in addition to bombing strikes now, the president has authorized in Syria itself. Bill, just a reality check. You at the Long War Journal know better than just about anybody what role Saudi Arabia has played historically in this global jihadist enterprise. Is it possible that you can have them play a constructive part in what the president's so-called strategy envisions at the moment, if it does not, in fact, mean that we have reliable partners in rolling up this Islamist ideology of which the Saudis are the font?
You know, Frank, as I always say, if you can't trust the Saudis and the Qataris to act in our best interest and deal with Islamist terrorists, then who can you trust? This is absolute madness. This is asking the fox to guard the hen house. And, you know, just pick your analogy. I'm still waiting for those redacted sections of the 9/11 report on Saudi Arabia to be declassified. The U.S. government is currently with the Qataris railing on them. The latest terrorist designations have been highly critical of the Qataris for their support of the al-Nusra Front and their inability to or unwillingness to go after financiers who are providing money to the al-Nusra Front, which is their rival to the Islamic State in Syria. It's al-Qaeda's official branch there. So it just shows how desperate we are that we're going to hold up the Saudis and the Qataris as being honest brokers to find to try and find moderate Syrian rebel groups. These guys have been backing not so moderate Syrian rebel groups. I'm not saying they're backing the al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State, but they're backing groups like the Islamic Front, which has top leaders of al-Qaeda in it. As a matter of fact, some of them were just killed in a bombing several days ago.
Right. And more to the point, these guys have been interrelating and, you know, swearing loyalty and fighting alongside each other and so on. And, you know, I guess the point, Bill, and we just have to wrap with this, is, you know, with friends like the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks, who needs enemies, really? And unfortunately, we've got a lot of them. Bill, I just can't tell you how much I appreciate personally, and I think all of our listeners do, and many beyond, obviously, the extraordinary work that you have done helping all of us make sense of this long war since the early days. after 9/11, thank you for helping us to both take stock of where we have come since then and for what you will be doing to help illuminate where we're going next. Keep it up, my friend. Next up, Fred Flights joins us. We'll take his temperature on this issue of the president's speech and the advisability of getting into Syria right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there, America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, I'm pleased to say, joined by one of our favorite career intelligence professionals, a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy and a man who has served with distinction in the Central Intelligence Agency, in former Undersecretary of State John Bolton's office, and on Capitol Hill on the Intelligence Committee. He is, of course, Fred Flights. Fred, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, as always.
Good to be here, Frank.
We're marking, of course, the 13th anniversary of 9/11, and I'm sort of doing stock-taking, I guess, with everyone about both what had happened on that occasion 13 years ago and, you know, where we find ourselves today. So welcome your thoughts.
Well, I remember it well. I was chief of staff to Undersecretary Bolton, who was Undersecretary for Arms Control and National Security on September 11, 2001. When the first plane hit the World Trade Center, I was in my office and we all thought it was an accident. And the second plane, and John was just getting out of the morning meeting with the secretary. The second plane hit, we knew it was a terrorist attack and we were all sort of panicking. When the plane hit the Pentagon, we could see the smoke from our windows. And Bolton immediately said, everybody out. He thought the State Department would be targeted. He just told us all to leave. We just cleared the State Department garage before they locked the building down for 6 hours. And there were fears that the State Department was targeted. There were stories of explosions outside the building. I couldn't call my family. The cell phone circuits were busy. And when I got home, my wife was just so happy. John stayed around, went into the situation room at State to try to coordinate the State Department response. It was really a harrowing day.
I can only imagine. And it reminds us all too vividly of what can happen on any other day. And whether it's the threat of terrorism from the so-called Islamic State, or whether it is from Al-Qaeda, or whether it is other elements of the global jihad, we've seen what can be done by determined individuals committed to our destruction, and we ignore it at our peril. Fred Flights is our guest, a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy. He is also the senior analyst at the Langley Intelligence Group Network. Lignet.com is where you can find his work as well. Fred, your sense of the president's address is another topic I'm interested in getting a read on. I know you have been supportive of late of the idea of using American air power to attack targets in Syria associated with this Islamic State group. The president is authorizing that. Does this please you about the president's strategy, and more generally, what do you make of it?
Well, the president's position has evolved considerably from previously saying there'd be no airstrikes, there'd be no boots on the ground. We now have the president's agreement that there will be airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. And he's claiming there won't be combat boots on the ground. But I'm concerned that a lot of what he said yesterday was incoherent and does not go far enough. I'm very concerned that he's trying to say that his plan to attack ISIS in Syria will be part of a strategy coordinated with moderate Syrian rebels. I don't know who these moderate Syrian rebels are, Frank. I don't know how many are left. We know they're collaborating with the al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda franchise in Syria. There have been reports that they've actually fought with ISIS and al-Nusra against the Syrian government. There's a credible report that so-called moderate Syrian rebels sold Stephen Sadov to ISIS for $50,000. There's real questions about who these people are. But at the end of the day, the Syrian rebels are not part of this equation. They're trying to cover up for the reality for the president that we have to attack ISIS in Syria, even though we know this will help the Assad regime. And basically, the president is trying to sidestep that unpalatable consequence.
It's unpalatable, not least because this brings us into alignment not just with Assad as a practical matter, but also with his chief sponsor, namely Iran. And Fred Flights, during your distinguished career at the agency and elsewhere in the government, you were, I think, one of the preeminent authorities on what Iran is up to. Let's talk a little bit about it. What is its role, or what has been its role with respect to this group, the Islamic State? And how have we seen these Shiites of Iran seemingly crossing the, we're told, insuperable barrier to collaborate with Sunnis, at least in their joint efforts to hurt the so-called infidels, namely us?
Well, what I'm seeing, Frank, is a heavy presence in Iraq of Iranians. And I think it's important that the United States not be tempted to cooperate with Iran in fighting against ISIS, because Iran is the reason for the sectarian warfare in Iraq. Iran is backing the Maliki regime. Iranian-trained Shiite militias have been massacring Sunnis. And, I mean, you can already see the writing on the wall that the administration is thinking about this, some type of cooperation. There's New York Times stories talking about cooperation between the Iraqi army and Iran in freeing a border village. We really can't go down this road. We need a substantially lower presence of Iran in Iraq. We shouldn't be increasing it.
Yeah, let alone enabling it. And Fred, speaking of Iran, one other aspect of that portfolio that you've covered closely is its nuclear program. It sure sounds as though the Iranians have figured that they've gotten basically what they wanted out of this so-called nuclear negotiation, which is relief from the sanctions. And there isn't going to be much more, even going through the motions, let alone real progress towards dismantling their nuclear capabilities. Because, among other things, the Russians are stepping in to help cushion them against whatever possible effort there might be to reconstitute sanctions. Is that how you see it? And how might this play out in the weeks ahead as we go into the UN General Assembly exercise and Rouhani, the president of Iran, shows up there to strut his stuff?
It looks like the international negotiations on the Iranian nuclear program will produce a very weak deal that will not roll back Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons. Iran will keep centrifuges. They'll probably keep the reactor that can produce plutonium. It's an extremely weak deal, and it will only last about 10 years. And it's just amazing that this is happening. On top of that, the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, recently came out with a report that Iran is defying a key aspect of an interim agreement that's behind the current talks. It will not answer questions about past work that clearly was related to nuclear weapons development. So the question now is the administration going to call Iran for its activities, or is it so desperate for a deal that it's going to sweep this under the rug, declare victory, and say we have an historic agreement? I'm worried the latter is what's
going
to happen.
Yeah, my money's on the sweepers. Quickly, talk what the Russians are doing on the intermediate range nuclear forces front. We have John Bolton's successor, Rose Gottmuller, apparently going over to try to see if she can't persuade them to conform to their treaty obligations. If that doesn't work, and I can't conceive of it doing so, what does it mean regionally as well as strategically that the Russians will be reconstituting prohibited INF capabilities?
Well, the INF is a treaty that bans ground-based missile and cruise missiles with a range of 500 to 5,500 kilometers. The Russians are testing a ballistic missile within that range, which they claim is a long-range missile. It's in violation of the treaty. Now, what Undersecretary Bolton is arguing is that this is a terrible treaty. Basically, the Russians have pulled out of it. Iran, North Korea, and all of our other adversaries can also make intermediate-range weapons, missiles. The correct response is we should pull out of this treaty, too. The Russians are clearly pulling out of it. They're going to ignore it. Well, we have so many threats around the world, including from Iran and North Korea. This is a treaty that served its purpose. It's time to move on. We should get out of it.
Well, I hope we'll do that, but also take advantage of the latitude we would then have to reconstitute our own intermediate range nuclear forces. I can't see that happening under this administration somehow, Fred Fleiss, but we'll be watching it closely, as I know will you, at the Langley Intelligence Group Network and at the Center for Security Policy. Keep up your great work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Congressman Rob Whitman, chairman of the House Readiness Committee, gives us an assessment of 9/11, the president's speech, and the readiness of America's military to deal with the war at hand. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute.
President Obama marked the 13th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks by unveiling the latest of his acts of serial national security fraud. His so-called new strategy reeks of cynical misdirection. For example, the president insisted that the jihadist Islamic State, or ISIL, whose destruction he seeks is, quote, not Islamic, unquote. Nonsense. His remarks were also deceptive about what it will take to roll back and defeat ISIL. Just U.S. airstrikes, Persian Gulf nations' money, and foreign boots on the ground. In fact, as Ronald Reagan showed, a successful commitment to defeat a hostile ideology in a truly global struggle requires the use of all instruments of national power. Only by doing so again can we hope to prevail against our time's totalitarians, the global jihadists, and their toxic agenda. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Congressman Rob Whitman. He represents with distinction Virginia's 1st District. It's also known as America's 1st District. He is a member of the House Armed Services Committee. He actually chairs its Readiness Subcommittee and serves on its Sea Power and Expeditionary Forces Subcommittee. He's one of our go-to guys on matters involving national security on the Hill because he actually is an expert on it and is practicing the business of oversight and providing for the common defense. Congressman Whitman, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Frank, it's great to be back with you.
We're observing today, of course, the 13th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and I'm sort of taking stock with our guests and would like to get your view as to where do you think we are 13 years on? Better off? Worse off? Facing a metastasizing enemy, an enemy that we frankly may not yet have adequately described, let alone fought?
Well, today, Frank, I believe that we have a better infrastructure in place to determine the depth and breadth of extremism around the world. I do think that extremism has grown. It is more diversified. It is more problematic, I believe, today as far as the threats it poses to the United States. So I would say that we are in a better position to be able to address it, but the threat is larger today than it was pre-9/11, and therefore it takes, I think, every bit of our attention to make sure that we are defeating this threat. I think this is a long-term challenge this nation faces, and I think we've heard that in the past when it was originally assessed that this is more than just a single group. It is an ideology, unfortunately, that's permeating a number of areas in the world, and it's one that we have to combat and have to be brutally honest about what it is. It is an ideology that directly confronts the United States, its security, and its interests around the world. And if we don't confront it with equal resolve or greater resolve, then in the end, the extremists win, and that's not where we want to be.
I'm heartened to hear much of what you just said, because I think it does indicate that we're dealing with something bigger than this outfit that the president insists on calling ISIL. And I just wonder, your choice of terms, Congressman, extremism, it sounds vaguely like the president saying last night, this has nothing to do with Islam. This is not Islamic. Is it your view that this is actually extremism that somehow can be removed from that context and practiced by people who make no bones about the fact that they're adhering to Sharia and they seek to impose it on everybody else?
No, I think it's clearly tied to the extremist form of Islam. I think it's clearly tied to that belief within a now increasing section of Muslim population. That is problematic. I don't think there's any way around that. I think if you don't acknowledge that, you minimize the overall impact of this and the overall breadth and scope of this. So I would disagree with the president as he turned to this is not Islamic. It is. It is the extremist view of Islam that now is permeating these groups throughout the world, and they look, as you said, to apply Sharia law through that, which means if you're considered an infidel, and that is if you do not believe in this fundamentalist form of Islam, then you are to be destroyed, period. Pretty simple.
This gives rise to a question about what you think you and your colleagues might do in response to the president's announcement last night that, well, I guess for want of a better term, we're going to war with this outfit, ISIL, in both Iraq and Syria. Will there likely be, in your estimation, in the limited time that you have before everybody heads to the hills for re-election purposes, for a new authorization for the use of military force? And if so, might it look like something that Congressman Frank Wolf, one of your colleagues from Virginia, has advanced that does address, I think, as part of the authorization, this idea that there is this ideology that underpins the enemies we're dealing with more broadly than just ISIL?
Well, Frank, I do believe Congress has a constitutional responsibility to act, and that is provide approval, permission, however you want to term it, to the president to pursue this conflict. Now, obviously, the president has some powers in a limited and short-term way to do this. What he outlined yesterday is a long-term effort, and the same thing Frank Wolf outlines in his legislation. This is a long-term effort to defeat and destroy ISIL and, in turn, these other extremist groups out there that seek to perpetrate death and destruction upon the United States. I think it is a broader perspective there. I do believe Congress has a constitutional requirement to do that. I do think that under the War Powers Act, it has to approve the long-term efforts the president is perpetrating here in pursuing war against these extremists. I think the War Powers Act also says that the president needs to come to us with specifics. He laid out four objectives yesterday. I don't believe that's a strategy. I believe they were four objectives. And I think he needs to come to Congress with the specifics of those. And then Congress needs to debate those specifics and give directive but specific language to the president as to how he pursues this war with these extremists.
Yeah. Just very quickly, yes or no, do you anticipate that there will be new direction in the foreseeable future, like the next 10 days, 2 weeks, on that line?
I know that there are conversations taking place right now. I hope that there is, but I cannot say definitively as we speak right now that there will or will not be. I believe strongly that there needs to be, though.
Let me turn quickly, because we're running out of time. Congressman Rob Whitman is our guest. He is the representative of the people of the 1st District of Virginia and a senior member of the House Armed Services Committee. I'd like to turn to your responsibilities on that committee as chairman of the Readiness Subcommittee. There's kind of a notion, I think, for many of us, Congressman, as we listen to the president make these pronouncements, and we're going to do airstrikes here, and we're going to do this there, and we're going to, you know, build up forces and so on, that this is all free. You mentioned infrastructure a moment ago, but the power projection capabilities of the United States are such that we can just do this without regard for who's paying for it, and actually the capabilities that are still present in our military. Would you talk a little bit about sequestration, the condition as you see it of the military at the moment, and the likelihood that if we do strap on still more of these kinds of missions, perhaps open-ended, perhaps quite long-term, that we are running a tab that nobody's quite clear about who's going to pay for it?
Well, Frank, that's a great point. You know, the sequester was meant to address a budget issue, was meant to force tough decisions. It didn't do that. It placed the vast majority of these cuts in a smaller portion of the budget, that is the defense budget, remembering, too, that there had already been almost $800 billion of cuts to the defense budget. Today, where we are is in a position where our strategy needs to be to fight and win a war on two fronts. Our readiness doesn't project the ability for us to do that, so our readiness is declining. And in the face of needing a greater element of readiness, especially with the threats we see around the world, we know the threat we're going to face here with extremists. But you have other threats. You have Russia. You have Putin there in the Ukraine. You have China, you have North Korea, all those. So we have to have the depth there. Now, you point out where the dollars come from. I think we have to, as we go into these budget debates, and it will not happen this year, unfortunately, but when the 114th Congress is seated, it has to take up the sequester. It has to take up the long-term impacts in our budget for this conflict, unlike what happened previous to that when we became engaged in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then continue to borrow money to do that. We have to deal with the budget realities of what it costs for us to defend this nation. And if we don't do that, we're doing this nation a disservice. And these are going to be tough decisions, but we have to be forthright and honest with the American people as to the true cost and making sure we're not trying to disproportionately balance a budget or address deficits and debt on the backs of our men and women in the military. It's an all-volunteer force. We ask them to do a very difficult job. You have to properly fund it. That means it's got to be efficient. We've got to do all we can to make the best use of the dollars there, but there is a cost associated with that. And by any measure, where we are today is in a state of declining readiness, not the position you want to be in facing this threat.
To say nothing of modernizing the forces and maintaining the kind of capacity, particularly among our seep-going forces, that we need to deal with these distant threats, as you said, not just the Islamist piece of it, but other nation-states as well. Congressman Rob Whitman, it is great to have a chance to visit with you. We are so grateful to you for what you do in the front lines of this war for the free world on Capitol Hill, and for all that we need to be doing to ensure that we keep ourselves safe in what's likely to be an even more challenging time in the years ahead. Thank you for joining us as well. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we'll be speaking with Admiral James Loy about his take on where we are 13 years after 9/11, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I lost my arm.
I lost my legs.
But you can't see what I lost. Over 625,000 vets are suffering from traumatic brain injury
and post-traumatic stress. They're the wounds you can't see.
But with your help, we can expose the invisible wounds of war.
And get these veterans the help they desperately need.
100% of your donation goes toward building treatment centers. Help heal the invisible wounds of war. Donate at makeitvisible.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at DailyCaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at DailyCaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I am very pleased to say we have a distinguished former senior military officer and public policy practitioner in the national security arena par excellence. He is Admiral James Loy. He was formerly the Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard. He served in several other important capacities, including as the first administrator of the Transportation Security Agency right after 9/11. He became the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, and today he is a senior counselor at the Cohen Group. It is an honor to have you with us, sir. Welcome.
Frank, nice to be with you again.
I'd like to start, I guess, as I have with each of our guests, Admiral, talking about your reflections on this 13th anniversary of 9/11, where we were on that day, where we've come, and what is in prospect as you see it now.
the day causes, especially all of us who were sort of in the belly of the beast on that particular day and the weeks and months that followed and years that have now followed, that we treat this day like so many of those days of infamy. Where were you then and what were you doing? The recollections come back fast and furious on a day like today. And this particular day, the 13th anniversary, especially in the immediate aftermath of the president's speech to the nation last night with regards to his strategic plan regarding ISIL. So to answer your question directly, you know, I think we were then in a mode of never having had the first shoe really drop on our country in the depth and terror-driven nature that it did on 9/11. We certainly had had the embassy events in Africa. We had certainly had the first World Trade Center event before. But to lose 3,000 lives in the extraordinarily public and horrible nature that occurred that day jarred us as literally a global civilization into the reality. The new nightmare on the horizon is something called terrors and terrorism, and that we all had to take it quite, quite seriously. And of course, all the organizational aftermath that followed, not only the 9/11 Commission report, but the executive branch and legislative branch activity that generated a TSA and generated new jobs for so many different agencies, and then eventually put together the new Department of Homeland Security, was sort of the organizational aftermath to a nightmare like that. I've always come to understand that such an event produces change, and I've sort of also come to understand that change is pretty constant. But my view is that change in and of itself, which we all have sort of a human resistance to, is compounded both in terms of pace, if you will, the pace of change. And now I'm convinced that there is an acceleration to the pace of change. So even as we speak today, our game plan and planning effort associated with tomorrow is even, certainly not at the desperate level, but even more important to be taken seriously than it was even on 9/11 when we were sort of learning all of that.
Admiral, let me ask you, if I may, about a specific piece of this lesson learning and adapting and coping with change that I wonder what you think, maybe against the backdrop of the president's speech, as you said last night. Are we clear, in your judgment, about the nature of the enemy we're up against? We had the president say last night it's not Islamic, and we're dealing with a lot of people who seem to be very much steeped in the same kind of, well, aspiration to impose Sharia on us that the ISIL guys do and the Al-Qaeda guys do, and yet they're described as friends and allies in this fight. What do we make of that character or the nature of the problem?
It's an excellent question. I was actually thinking the same thing when the president sort of briefly passed across this notion of ideology, claiming that it was not Islamic. I think there's so much for us to still learn about that, and therefore the clarity associated with the nature of the enemy is something that is part of this change dynamic that we have to face up to. I can remember in the early days working with my British colleagues, Canadian colleagues, others around the world when we were just standing up DHS and just standing up TSA. You know, the word of the day then was radicalization, and whether we were understanding what that meant adequately enough to cope with it and deal with it, I mean, even define it, let alone try to understand it so as to be able to do something about it. And I think that's still a new version today. I mean, in those days, Al-Qaeda was the enemy, and Osama bin Laden was its head. And in the change window between then and 13 years later, we have done, in my mind, an excellent job of taking down the front office, if you will, of Al-Qaeda, only to find that in the same manner that when you take down a drug cartel leader, all of a sudden the five lieutenants that were part of that organization start five new cartels. And so along that same pathway, having taken down the leading lights of Al-Qaeda, now we find ourselves with at least five or six named versions of Al-Qaeda of the same persuasion, ISIL being one of them, but what holds it all together is the caliphate kind of talk that you were describing just a moment ago. It seems to be the denominator. And so I think we continue to learn about that, but we ought to be focusing on it as dramatically as we can, given this new version of what's now maybe a 13-year-old enemy, but has very different shapes, very different clothes, and very different locations, seems to be concentrating on the Middle East and North and West Africa, but with this notion of how many hundreds of Americans are over there fighting and learning and bringing those notions back, we need to be quite, quite concerned about how we're learning about
them. And there's no question that their aspirations are global. And I think you've very nicely described this danger that we are going to continue to think of this as kind of a microcosm-only problem, and we can deal with it sort of symptomatically rather than systemically. Admiral, there's so much to talk about, and we're running hard out of time here. But very quickly, this point you've just made about people coming to this country, either having passports after engaging in the jihad over there or coming across what remains, it seems, a very porous border. One of the particular pieces of this threat environment that I'm concerned about, and I'd just be very interested in your view, is do you think it is possibly another example of the kind of failure of imagination, as the 9/11 Commission said, about our situational awareness prior to that horrible day 13 years ago, that we're not better focused on the vulnerability of something that could really be an existential threat to this country, were one or the other of these bad actors to take advantage of the vulnerability of our electric grid?
You're absolutely right. I think the notion of borders is part of this change dynamic. I mean, if you would have asked me that question about borders 13 years ago, my mind would have taken me to my responsibilities as then the commandant of the Coast Guard and the ports and waterways of our country, and I would have immediately pulled into my, you know, the front lobe of my brain a picture of the United States with an existent geographic border with Canada and a geographic border with Mexico. But today, I think we must extrapolate the notion of what constitutes this thing called a border, and therefore the challenge called border security, to include the cyber implications of electronic opportunities that the enemy has to bring this country to its knees with regard to electrical grids, power dams, SCADA systems that control those kinds of manifestly foundational parts of our economy and parts of our way of life.
Truly critical infrastructure.
Absolutely. And I think the one thing that we might be thinking well about, I've noticed, you know, the word resilience has found its way into our vocabulary. And I think, unfortunately, if you ask 10 different people, you get 10 different definitions. But in there somewhere is the general notion of being able to not only recover from an event, whether it's man-made or whether it's, you know, the hurricane or the
solar storm.
Exactly. That not only to recover, but to regain the same level of productivity and activity that existed before the event. The notion of being able to restore that quickly is this capture of something that we call resilience.
Admiral, I'm afraid we're way over time, but I just can't thank you enough for taking this time with us on this day, particularly to share with us your experiences in the senior ranks of the United States government 13 years ago and in the days and years that followed. Keep up the good work, sir. Come back to us. I hope you will in the near future, and I hope the rest of you will again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.